So far, we've been talking about what we've called the prophetic cycle in religion, in religious history, a cycle in which one prophet after another foretold the coming of what, in the Christian terms, is the kingdom of God on earth. And last time, we were focused on the role of the Bab in closing that cycle and in opening what has been called the cycle of fulfillment. And so what and that means the fact that what we are engaged in today, we Baha'is, is the building of the foundations of this kingdom. Now, what one has to remember, I think, is that probably what is probably the case with most members of the major faiths that you can think of, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, the coming of the Day of Judgment or the establishment of the Kingdom of Heaven or whatever was something that was going to take place on another realm entirely, in some sort of metaphysical realm. It wasn't understood as something that humanity itself is going to be very much involved in. It was going to be done for humanity, or if you like, to humanity, and then humanity would benefit from it. That's clearly not at all what the Baha'i dispensation entails. And so what I'd like to do, perhaps before going any further, is reading a couple of sentences from Baha'u'llah, which discuss this day and its implications. He says, "The purpose underlying all creation is the revelation of this most sublime, this most holy day, the day known as the Day of God in His books and scriptures. This is the day in which God's most excellent favors have been poured out upon man, the day in which His most mighty grace hath been infused in all created things." And he gives a very interesting analogy. "This day a door is open wider than both heaven and earth. An act, however infinitesimal, is, when viewed in the mirror of the knowledge of God, mightier than a mountain." So something, we're talking about something entirely different. It was the Bab who inaugurated this cycle, but the day of fulfillment is the Baha'i dispensation. It is the work of Baha'u'llah. He is not merely inaugurating it. The work that he has done has already begun to lay the foundations. And what all religion has always understood is that when this day comes, one of its, in fact, perhaps its most distinguishing feature is the unity of mankind. And that day there will be one fold and one shepherd. Mankind will be one people, or at least, I suppose, people of many of other religions would have said the saved, at least, would be members of a single community inhabiting the city of God, which would have descended out of heaven. Well, how is this unity to be achieved, if unity is the characteristic of the Day of God? Baha'u'llah makes a very, very challenging statement. He says the instrument that achieves unity, it's not love, it's not any of these other highly positive qualities that people have come to cherish in religion in the past. It is justice. This is the day of justice. Justice, it is justice in human affairs that will produce unity. Very much like in the development of a human being, when he arrives at the point of maturity and he can accept responsibility, something different happens to him. He has taken charge of his own life, of his own future, his own relationship with other people. Justice is that point in the collective life of mankind, the operation of justice in human affairs. The proof of the power of justice to bring about unity, the unarguable proof, is the existence of the Baha'i community. Without wanting to sound, I guess one is going to sound extravagant, perhaps, because God is pretty extravagant, and certainly what he's doing in this day is very extravagant. The Baha'i community is a miracle. It's unique. There is no association of human beings, whether it's religious, political, social, whatever you want to call it, on Earth today that has survived even its early years, let alone its later years, with its unity intact. The blight of faction and sect and denomination and party is universal. And it's not only today, of course, it's throughout history. Never before has there existed on Earth a community of people, and particularly one drawn from the whole diversity of humankind, that functions as one organized community. And in the process of achieving that goal, Baha'is have seen the old threat of sectarianism completely defeated. Sectarianism can no more survive in a Baha'i context, in a Baha'i society, a Baha'i community, life, than earthworms or bugs could survive in the bright sunlight of a noonday. And they never have. And so if you take a look at Baha'i history, and it's very useful for anybody who is interested in this subject to take a look at some of the passages, say the last third of the Guardian's book, God Passes By, and you see the complete dissolution of every single attempt to break up the Baha'i community in different parties or different factions or so on. The Baha'i community, therefore, is the proof, and again, let me say the unarguable proof, that humanity in all its diversity can learn to live and work as one human family in one global homeland, in one homeland, which is the planet itself. And you can't argue with this. You can't say that's not possible for people, and a lot of people, I guess, who say that today, because some 5 million people with the whole diversity of the human race entailed have done it quite successfully. And as the community grows, the strengths that come from unity, as Baha'u'llah promised would be the case, have steadily increased. So in a sense, you could say, in an important sense, I think, it's fair to say that the Baha'i community is a model. At the very least, it's an encouraging model to others who are hoping that humanity can overcome this propensity to war and so on and create a global society. And let me give you, it's worthwhile pausing, I think, to take a couple of examples. But take the law of hukuk Allah in the Baha'i faith. Now hukuk Allah is an expression of divine justice. For the rest of our lives, we give to the cause what we want to do. We give whatever each one of us gives, whatever he or she chooses to give. He or she gives it in complete confidentiality, and feels perfectly at one with God in doing so, because God said that this is exactly what we're free to do. However, there is one additional feature in this whole area of human activity, and that is this law of hukuk Allah, or the right of God. Because God is pretty smart. He realizes that I, for example, or anybody else, when I think of giving a contribution to the Baha'i Fund, I will tend to favor those things that are closest to me, my own locality, my own national community. And they get the bulk of the funds I contribute, but then I give a smaller amounts, perhaps to continental or international funds. Well, God isn't satisfied with that, because the result of that, obviously, is that Baha'i communities that are in wealthy nations will prosper, will never have any problem drawing funds, or at least they won't have a lot of problem in drawing the funds necessary to accomplish what they want. What about the rest of humanity, where the societies themselves, the economies, are at the bottom of the heap? And the law of hukuk Allah is the means by which God plans to take care of that, because each Baha'i, when he gives to the trustees of this fund 19% of everything that he has left after he has paid all his own expenses, after he has lived as he feels he should live. 19% goes to this, and that those funds are used for the whole the progress of the faith throughout the whole world. Now, these are early days, but what we're talking about, if you throw your imagination into the future, we are talking here about a massive transfer of capital in a Baha'i society on a scale that we could would boggle the mind today if you began to think of it. Baha'u'llah simply intends to establish justice in the distribution of human wealth without taking away the rights of people in parts of the world which have money, lots of money, to function in every other aspect of their lives as their own particular inclination prompts them to do. What's another example? Well, take Baha'i elections. I hear you, if when the votes are counted and there's a tie vote between one person and a second person who represents some minority, some disadvantaged minority in that particular society, the latter person automatically is elected. You could say that's very arbitrary, but the purpose of it obviously is to assist and encourage disadvantaged minorities to catch up with the rest of society. And what is entailed in all of these examples is authority. We have arrived at the point in human history where authority is going to be exercised in a way that not only is beneficial and positive for the future of humankind, but is going to be recognizable as such, as people at least give it a chance. Because whatever else one can say, authority is absolutely essential to any organized activity. We live in an age when people are in full flight from authority, whether it's parental authority or religious authority, political, whatever, educational and so on. And that's understandable perhaps to some degree at least because of the way authority has been abused. But it doesn't change the fact that without authority, nothing is possible. No organized activity is possible, and the conditions under which humanity would have to live in a society without it are unimaginable. Let me just give you one other example before I go on, and that's in Baha'i consultation. Here you have a law of consultation, the exercise, quite a clear exercise of authority on the part of Baha'u'llah, in which a decision is taken after consultation, and there may be a minority of people who don't agree, but they are required then to support it. There's no place for Her Majesty's loyal opposition in the functioning of Baha'i consultation. But at the same time, the group, the whole group, the institution that has made this decision, including obviously the majority who have voted for it, must also be ready and willing and open to examining the consequences of the decision so that if it proves to be faulty, they will be equally, as much as the other people, they will be ready to abandon their attachment to it and accept a reconsideration of the principle that's under discussion. Now obviously, God's love and God's mercy are going to continue to be at the very heart of the Baha'i dispensation as they have throughout religious history, because that's the nature of God. God is loving, God is merciful. The only thing that keeps us from experiencing his love and his mercy, Baha'u'llah says, is because we ourselves are not loving. If we are loving, then that love reaches us. But this does not change the fact that in this new dispensation, this dispensation of fulfillment, it is justice that is the really ruling principle of the conduct of human affairs. And it is that ruling principle because it is through justice, as I've said, that unity is achieved. And unity is the absolute requirement of any future development of civilization. So all of the context of all of this, of everything I've been saying, is the collective coming of age of humankind. And the coming of age of humankind collectively, as with an individual, is the requirement to grow up. We are being challenged, we as a people on this planet are being challenged to grow up, to mature, to accept responsibility, to accept the fact that some of our behavior has to be disciplined, that, for example, that, Baha'u'llah says that all of the natural wealth of the planet belongs to the entire human race. And if this makes us uncomfortable, it's getting out of our comfort zone is going to be part of growing up. We experience it in our personal lives. Why would we expect not to experience it in our collective life? But because we're rational souls, we have to do our very best, I think, as Baha'is, not merely to obey, not merely to submit, but as I think I mentioned in another context, but to understand. To understand why and how these evolutionary processes work, and to keep in mind constantly that we're not talking just about other people. If we're going to be useful to the human race, if we're going to provide a model, if we're going to provide encouragement, then we have to understand that we ourselves will be facing these challenges first, and we will not be useful if we have not responded to these challenges. That's what's ahead of us. The very fact that the cause is a stage in an evolutionary process, even though it's at a moment the stage where everything has changed, everything has reached a moment of fulfillment, nevertheless, it's a process that we're challenge to look at, and if we ever fall into the habit of imagining that we have arrived and the rest of poor mankind is still struggling in the darkness, then we ourselves have missed the boat completely. It's to the extent that we face the inevitable challenges that authority presents us with. The minute you encounter authority, you are challenged. You are challenged to begin to think, why is this authority, do I understand what the authority is requiring? Do I understand why that authority is requiring it? Am I imagining that here I'm still dealing with my father or something, or my grade one school teacher? No, authority is the authority that God has, the authority I'm speaking about, is the authority that God has expressed for the guidance of mankind. And that's the goal that we have constantly to keep in mind. Let me just close these comments, which are perhaps too extensive already, but all of the great religions have pointed us to the enormity of the changes that are taking place today. In the past, I think people have tended to think of the coming of the kingdom of heaven or the descent of God out of heaven, as in Islam, as something that would take place in some sort of a metaphysical realm in which things are just done for us, and we accept it and benefit from it. But that's not the kind of actual wording of the prophetic scriptures. The Bible says, in that day the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established at the top of the mountains, and all nations shall flow unto it. This is very much something above this world. It's not some realm out in space, up in the sky or so on. The same thing is true in the gospel. St. John says, and I saw the holy city coming down from God out of heaven, and the glory of the Lord shall be its light. It will be here on earth. It will be, he compares it to a city, and the light that he's speaking of, obviously, is the light of understanding that will make possible for people to live together as one global society. And the Quran extends this, as it very often does, to in one sweep to the whole of the planet, it says, even as we produced the first creation, so shall we produce a new one, a promise we shall certainly fulfill.